Visit atthebestu.ca to browse our online courses and transform your academic journey.
On CFRC 101.9 FM every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., you'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephoned interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
Folk Everything is your passport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name's CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Lynn Wottam, who is doing a Master's in Religious Studies under the supervision of Dr. Amarnath Amarizingam. Welcome to Grad Chat, Lynn.
Thank you, Colette. I am extremely excited to be here.
Well, actually, I'm excited to do this topic too. It's a bit of a doozy, as I would say. I think everyone's going to enjoy it. I think I need to say this particular topic is very topical right now. And so this recording is being done at the end of July, but of course you're all hearing it in September. So just please keep that in mind with the information that Lynn is going to share with us. Who knows what's going to change between, you know, July and September. So I just want to put that out there for everyone. First of all, Lynn, I want to find out from you, why did you want to come on Grad Chat? Why was that important to you?
Well, I think people who know me know that I love to talk. And so being able to talk for 30 minutes to just a captive audience out there is great for me.
By the way, Lynn's got a little card saying slow down
yes.
here.
Because I tend to talk fast as well, people have told me. So I have so enjoyed my research over the last year. And I've been getting really into it and passionate about it. And I have a friend in the same program. And she told me about this. And she's like, Lynn, you should do this. And I just was like, this is exactly what I should do. And so I've been looking forward to this.
Well, I love people who are enthusiastic about coming on the radio. And as we say, you know, part of coming on Grad Chat is that learning experience. It's one, getting the message out there, but also what you can learn about. How do I tell people about my topic, which I don't think you're going to have any trouble telling people about your topic. So I'm going to break the suspense. And Lynn's topic is called the Trump Prophecy Movement. And what you're doing here is mapping out and understanding the rise, power, and resiliency of modern Christian prophecy among American evangelical voters relate to Donald Trump's presidency. So I guess my first question is to you, what do you mean by prophecy? Because that word conjures up a lot of meaning for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I should say, too, my area of expertise before this has really been the ancient world. I have spent a lot of time studying the biblical texts.
Right.
I went to school in Carleton for my undergrad in classical studies.
Okay.
So much more familiar with understanding ancient texts, ancient prophecy. I was not expecting to completely shift gears on my master's program and look at how does modern prophecy impact modern politics. So that has been quite an adventure. I would say, so I think to understand this, you need to understand that since the 1970s, but really since the 1990s, there has been a growing network movement of charismatic Christianity that has taken on a new leadership model of how the church is supposed to be run. And it's not a denomination, it's not with pastors, but there's been this revival of what they consider as modern day apostles and prophets. And so within this new kind of charismatic expression of restoring apostles and prophets to leadership in a network of Christian communities, they essentially do believe that there are modern day prophets who hear from God and give vision for Christians to essentially, they're trying to implement a divine agenda for America, their nation, or the world.
Right.
So there really are these figures who are seen as having a prophetic mantle, or prophets who speak on behalf of God for the sake of guidance going forward. And some of these figures have brought about prophecies relating to Trump and how they believe Trump fits in with this greater goal of what they believe God wants to do in America.
It's interesting, though, because you said starting in the 1970s. I mean, there's a lot of those people who say they were prophets who have then been put in jail for all sorts of things.
Yes.
Basically frauding or those sorts of areas. And I guess the other thing I wanted to check on that is that when you're talking about this movement, is it only happening in North America or America or the USA, or is it happening across the world before we get back onto the Trump section?
Yeah, it's happening around the world. Charismatic Christianity is really the growing just expression of Christianity globally. So no, these networks, these apostolic prophetic networks do extend across nations. But in my research, I'm looking particularly about how I argue in my paper, I try to overlay that with, are there some Christian nationalist ideologies that also find themselves within some of this particular American expression of it?
Right.
I argue that there is some. And so it takes a unique form within American politics and Trump.
And when you say Christians or Christianity, I mean, there's lots of denominations within the term Christianity.
Yes.
Because is it Catholics who should be following the Pope? Because that's the, you know, God gave the Pope, gave us the Pope kind of thing.
Yes.
Or is it Church of England, or is it Methodist, is it evangelical?
Yeah.
Is it all of them or certain sectors of Christianity?
Yeah. This is where it gets difficult, because this particular new expression of modern day apostles and prophets and leadership, it transcends denominations.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have people of different denominational leanings all seeing themselves as united within this modern apostolic movement.
Right.
So it's very difficult to map. It's very difficult to get numbers about, because it's not actually a denomination, which is also part of the strength to it as well. Because whereas
it's crossing boundaries.
Yes. And whereas a traditional denomination kind of has set leaders that can rise or fall, this network is so flexible in that even if one particular apostle or prophet do something wrong, there's a whole network that still are functioning. And even with some of the prophecies, they're very loose. They get shared very easily, transcending denominational boundaries, but they become a part of the thinking in people's minds.
I actually find this fascinating because, you know, I'm a Christian and some of the things I'm seeing don't seem very Christian-like.
Yes.
Which is tricky, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you do see this is even within Christianity, this particular movement is rather divisive as well.
Right.
Because when you have people saying there are modern day prophets and they're speaking this particular divine plan for America, and Trump is a part of that, if people disagree with that, then there becomes this tension.
Okay, so let's get on to the evangelical support for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So you've written here in your synopsis that actually started for the 2016 elections, or did it start from when he got in?
Yes. So this is what I was interested about in my initial research, was trying to say, where did this begin?
Mm-hmm.
And in my research, I pretty much map out five initial, what I call early prophets, who either prophesied something about Trump before his 2016 win, or later followers claimed that they had almost in cryptic code. It's a little bit unclear.
Right.
So it really is a mixed bag. But I do think there you do have at least five solid figures that form the roots of this movement who said that Trump was going to win the 2016 election early within 2015, which at that point, this is what makes it seem so miraculous to people right. after he won, because you do see modern evangelical leaders when Trump won. It just seems so astounding. And they're thinking there were people who prophesied this even in 2015 when Trump was not doing that great and did not have evangelical backing in the way that he eventually did. So there's a combination of factors, but that I kind of start the roots of the movement
from that.
And then 2016 became a significant moment of vindication for these early prophecies, which then snowballed into leading up to 2020. You have at least 40 individual prophets within this network saying Trump is going to win, and then he doesn't. And then that leads to essentially a crisis within the movement.
So these 40 self-determined prophets are saying this.
Yes.
So their congregational ministry or whatever.
But that's where some of them would have been in leadership. Some of them just had maybe a particular following on social media. Really, for this leadership structure to work, you just need a sizable group of people who say, yeah, we think you're a prophet too. And then you get some things right and it just grows.
Yes, we proved it.
Yes.
Proved it. So you are a prophet. So we're not saying Trump is the prophet here. We're saying the movement has the prophets within the movement are saying, this is what's going to happen, etc.
Yes.
So as the particular, you said it's non-denominational, but is there more leaning towards one Christian group over another?
I mean, it's definitely charismatic. Mm-hmm. But the thing about the charismatic movement starting in 1940s, 50s, 60s is it already was interdenominational.
Right.
There was Pentecostalism, which was very much a denomination. But then the charismatic renewal, when it affected the Catholic Church or just, Episcopalians, it had this reach. And so, it's definitely charismatic. But I would say some of these prophecies, and we can talk a little bit about, if you want to, how these prophecies function.
Yes.
They just become these kind of transportable symbols that even if you're not even aware of this particular movement or think about it, you probably have heard maybe of some of these prophecies. And they can kind of fit in with your theology irrespective.
And this is very different to Nostradamus and his prophecies.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I haven't read Nostradamus, but it depends. I think these particular prophets, they're so diverse, and how their prophecies function is diverse too. So I would say maybe some are a little bit more like Nostradamus, they're a bit more in code. And then some are very outright, being like Trump is going to win the 2016 election.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so when Trump didn't win the 2020, what were these prophets then saying? I mean, I guess that's all part of it. Because one minute they're saying, no, I've been told he's going to win.
Yeah.
And then they didn't. So does that sort of make them people think that that prophet is not a prophet?
That is the most fascinating part of my research, because really I was trying to understand how does prophecy engage with modern day politics, but also I'm fascinated about, I did a paper in one of my classes looking at social psychological studies of, we have so much evidence of when there's a group that has a specific prophecy and prophetic disconfirmation ensues, the belief remains. You see groups that when a prophecy clearly doesn't come to pass, there are these rationalization techniques within the human mind.
But they find a reason why.
Exactly. And social psychologists have studied and tried to map out what are some of those different factors within human reasoning that can allow these communities to endure. And they oftentimes do. And so even past 2020, the final section of my essay, I really divide it into three parts.
Okay.
I divide it into power, consolidation, resilience. And power is the roots, is the foundational early pre-2016 prophets. I talk then about the consolidation period. So in 2016 to 2020, that was a time in which they were able to popularize these prophets. People were, these prophecies, people were talking about them more. Books were being published, like cataloging these prophecies. And it seemed very much as legitimation of, oh, God wanted to do this. And Trump really is God's chosen president. But then 2020 onward, I talk about resilience, and I pretty much structure it like it's like a tree. And after the trunk of the consolidation period, once 2020 is a moment of prophetic disconfirmation, the movement kind of splinters, and one branch goes off, and I call them repenter prophets. Some of these prophets did publicly say, we got this wrong.
Okay.
And but
that was big of them, because not you wouldn't think those kind of people would.
Yes, it was. But what's interesting is you see considerable backlash from people who followed them saying, you are now a false prophet because the word was correct, but you're backtracking on it. Right. So they got considerable backlash. But then there are people who I call loyalist prophets, and they remain firm in their belief that the prophecies were correct. But I map out three individual ways that they navigated forward. One was the conditionalist branch. And so they said the prophecies were true, but it was conditional upon the church praying, the church voting, or Trump being humble. Some people said because he was too prideful, God took back what he wanted to do for a second term. So that's the conditionalist branch.
Right.
There was what I call the apocalyptic branch, which is pretty much, it turns the prophecies into almost like, well, the prophecies were true, but we need a hidden insight into how they're functioning. So these prophecies, this was always what God intended, but God is working behind the scenes.
Right.
And Trump is really truly the president in like with heavenly authority. And, you know, these prophets are saying there will be a moment in which we will be shown as vindicated, that there will be a great disclosure within the government and all of this information will pop out. And the prophets who stayed loyal will be seen as vindicated, and those who shrunk back will be judged for it.
Right.
So it's very apocalyptic in that sense of we know this hidden knowledge now, but there will be a day of great reckoning. This has yet to happen. It's always this prophesied, they've been prophesying this imminent exposure for all of 2020, 2021, 2022, up until the present.
Right.
It has not really panned out yet, but it's always there. And I say the last branch is the conspiratorial branch, and I map out ways in which there is this convergence of these holding firm to these prophecies and then denying the election and saying the election was stolen, some QAnon theories, just this idea of a deeper conspiracy.
Is that close to the apocalyptic one, though?
It is. And that's where I'm like, this is where my research is difficult, because it's all ideological and it's not, there's no clear boundaries, and ideas are passed around very freely. And so I do map out, there are some prophets who fit sometimes overlapping with multiple of these branches. And these ways of navigating failed prophecy are very flexible, very pragmatic.
Yes. Well, that's a good academic that can be flexible.
Yes, yeah.
Because things are changing daily.
Yes.
Which is why I made that statement at the beginning, because things are changing daily. But what made these prophets choose Trump?
That is a fantastic question. What I found interesting was in my research was there was, I do have to say, there was a compelling aspect of some of these early prophets. I don't, sometimes when you get religion, people want to look at other explanations that drive people. And they say, religion's not really the explanation. Like, people aren't radicalized really because of religion. It's because of economic factors or social factors. But I do think that with these prophets, the prophecy itself and the religious understanding around these prophecies was a huge factor in some people voting for Trump.
Right.
Some of these prophecies, I could get into details about them, but there's a lot of details. Some of these early prophecies were convincing enough for people that when Trump won, the earliness of them was shocking to them. And I think I have yet to find any similar prophecies among this network of prophets for people like Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or similar ones. There is something interesting about the Trump prophecies.
Right.
And even these early prophets who got some of these prophetic words, they even attest to the fact, at least the way they claim, was that they were shocked early on. They're like, I don't know why God was telling me this, but this is what he said. And they got considerable backlash for it early on too. So one of these prophecies came from a man named Lance Wallnau in the fall of 2015. And his was interesting because he really popularized this prophecy that Trump is a modern day Cyrus. Have you ever heard of anything like that? That sometimes
no.
is a... Okay.
No. So, do you want to explain that?
Yes. So Lance Wallnau, his prophecy was, he says that he was looking at a picture of Donald Trump in the fall of 2015, and it said underneath it, the 45th president, almost as like he's going to be our 45th president.
Right.
He says at that moment, he heard God's voice say, read Isaiah 45. And so he's like, I don't know what was in Isaiah 45. He opens it up, and Isaiah 45 is a Old Testament prophecy about the king of Persia named Cyrus. And in that prophecy, it says, though you do not know me, I will use you, King Cyrus, who was not Jewish. He was, quote unquote, a pagan, an unbeliever.
Right.
He was not an upstanding person. But in Isaiah's prophecy, he's like, I will use Cyrus to deliver my Jewish people from Babylon and to restore the temple and to be a part of my plan for God's people. That particular quote-unquote prophecy, he claims it's a prophecy because he says God spoke it to him.
Right.
He has done a fantastic job at popularizing that. That has become almost this very resilient idea, which has allowed evangelical voters to vote for Trump, believing he is God's divinely appointed man, even if his character is lacking. He does not have to be a Christian. He does not have to be a man of great moral standard. All he has to be is fitting within this Cyrus, King Cyrus prophecy mandate.
Wow.
And so that particular is an example of how this people don't even know necessarily that this Cyrus prophecy goes back to Lance Wallnau, but it has become so diffused within people's thinking and theology surrounding justification for Donald Trump and supporting him that, yeah, I think it demonstrates the power of some of these ideas.
It's extremely powerful, but why, I mean, you've talked about why Trump, but why don't these prophets, and maybe it is on economics and things like that, why have these prophets not done this something similar to other presidential nominees in the past?
I mean, I frame the context of my essay within two particular prophetic moments, because I do think charismatic prophecy has intersected with American politics in the past. I talk about how there was a prophecy about Ronald Reagan in 1970, and he became president, I think, 1980.
Right.
So a decade before, where there was this man who was praying for him, and he said, and he was shaking, and he prophesied, if you humble yourself, God will put you in the White House. And he put that in writing, and it did happen. But yet that prophecy was one prophecy. It ended up working out, but it lacked the power of these modern day Trump prophecies. But there was also with Mitt Romney in the 2012 election, there was a growing number of these modern day prophets who really believed that God had chosen Mitt Romney to beat Obama, but he also did not. So we see in that movement, it's something similar to the Trump prophecy, but it lacked a moment of vindication that could make it strong. They had these sort of prophecies, but then it didn't work out. And so the movement didn't grow.
Do you think this one has got so big because of social media?
Yeah, I would 100%.
I mean, I wonder if those other ones you mentioned, had they had social media or the World Wide Web in those days, whether they also would have got to this.
Potentially. I do think social media is a very significant factor. And also that social media works within this very loose network of this new, what they call the movement is the New Apostolic Reformation. So NAR. So if you see NAR, that's New Apostolic Reformation.
Okay.
Yes. So that's this new kind of what they would say, return to prophets and apostles leading the church. Social media 100% is super, super.
It's reaching more people.
Definitely. And there's one scholar who talks within this movement, how ideas get transferred are what he calls prophetic memes, which I think is very helpful because you see this prophetic network. All these prophets are saying a lot of things. They say a lot of things. They make a lot of predictions. But some predictions become these almost prophetic memes that they end up working out for whatever reason. You know, perhaps it's because God wanted it to work out, or perhaps it's just because of circumstances. But they work out, and these ideas become... are easily detached from the original context, and they kind of get riffed on like normal memes.
Right.
Some memes take hold within culture, and they just become a part of the common vernacular
right. And
theology within this system of thinking. And so I think that's where social media, these prophetic memes, Trump is Osiris, and so Trump will be a trumpet, or Trump is like a bull in a china shop, or like all of these memes were easily passed around and started to inform people's thinking about Trump.
I still have a problem in that these prophets are saying this within the Christian faith.
Yeah.
And yet they've, if I've heard you correctly, some of them have admitted that in this situation, Trump is not necessarily a nice person,
yeah. But
we still think he's the one.
Yeah.
And yet that's not Christian. Because Christianity is love thy neighbor.
Yes. I think for this particular Christian movement, understanding that they believe that God wants to transform societies.
Mm-hmm.
And a part of that is getting key people with Christian influence in particular areas of society to bring influence, like the government.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them... having a particular presidential figure that God has chosen for this particular moment to what they would say, turn America back to God. They believe that America is going down the wrong path
right. And
kind of losing its original calling to be this great nation that glorifies God.
Okay.
And Trump serves to steer that direction in a different way.
Even though he
said he wasn't really a Christian. Yes.
And from the reports just recently.
And that's where they do pull on these prophetic ideas like King Cyrus, right? Where they're like, well, there's precedent within the Bible that you don't have to be a believer to be used by God in a key moment in history for the sake of his bigger plan.
So the Christian prophets are wanting to use one person, happened to be named Trump, to make that change.
Yes.
To make.
And I think I look at these prophets and they are people who really do believe that this is what God wants. And that this is the best thing for America. And this is the best thing for people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a complicated.
It will be interesting reality. To see the next election of whatever the outcome is, what happens with these prophets.
Yeah.
Or prophecies.
Yeah.
So this would be the third election, right?
Yeah.
Of when it first this Trump prophecy started.
Yeah.
Movement.
I am tremendously interested to see, no matter what happens, what's going to happen with the movement.
That sounds like you're going to have to do a PhD.
Yeah. That's where I was telling you it's shocking to go from studying ancient history, where if you study like the Peloponnesian War, that's all done, and there's been but I am handing in my essay months before
the election,
in which things could change. Like this movement could take a radically different turn. It could die out. It could become stronger.
Right.
I don't know.
And that, as an academic, that's exciting, but also a bit scary, isn't it? Because how good is your paper?
Yeah.
If it suddenly changes.
Exactly. I think I feel proud and confident that whatever, because I've just looked at the past.
Yes.
I'm not making any predictions.
No, that's true.
I've just looked at the past and I've been like, I think up to this point, I've done a reasonable job of taking as much data as I can and mapping this out and explaining how is this movement so particularly powerful and resilient despite like Trump's loss in 2020. So I feel good about that, but I'm always excited for feedback because I'm sure I will change my mind in a couple of years if I was to look at it again.
But it does make it exciting though, yeah. I think, because not like you said, not everyone has a topic that is constantly changing day to day.
Yeah.
I mean, normally they say, you know, there's new literature that's coming out on a particular topic that have to take in consideration. And we're always saying, well, at some stage you've got to stop and just write
it. Yes, exactly.
This is exactly happening. Yep. The fortunate thing for you, it's changing daily.
Yes. When there's the shooting and the assassination attempt on Trump, I became that guy where multiple people were texting me, what are the prophets saying about this? is, right?
Right,
I've become this very particular niche expert in this very bizarre scenario.
It is fascinating, though. I mean, I take my hat off you for taking the challenge of even bringing this topic to the forefront, which we need to, because we need to have an understanding of where things have come to make today what it is today.
Right.
Whether we agree with it or not,
right.
people have to have a better an awareness.
Right. And I think this movement has shown me that prophecy can be very powerful and very resilient. I think the question for me is, what future are we prophesying towards? And that's what I think is the critical question.
Well, it's probably a good place to stop then, isn't it?
It's been great talking to
you. Because we can't answer that right now.
Yes.
No, well, Lynn, thank you so much for coming on the show. I've learned a lot from this 29 minutes, so I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you for letting me have the opportunity to share.
Oh, that's good. No, I'm glad you did. And like I said, it was going to be a doozy, and you've followed through on that. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray. Grad Chat.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
You are listening to CFRC Radio from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca.
Sego.
Buju anim.
Danach a ak anzeni shukwithan.
Tante.
Ay, ino halingay.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Ay ino katikay maglan alakarel lawonga o kati niyaktasinga tamatumani harita o yakut na lahat talaga tilugit inutito kausibun ni pichute halunga.
Hello everyone, I'm Madeline Alekarelek and I'm your last host in these amazing episodes of Words and Culture. I am an Inuk woman who was born and raised in Canada's second most northern community. If you can have a quick look at a map, you'll spot Resolute Bay. That's far, hey? Yeah, still in Canada. A quick fact for you, my family was forcefully moved way up to the high Arctic in the 1950s from a community called Inukjuak. And that's in Nunavik, here in northern Quebec, so that Canada can be Canada. We were used as flagpoles. I was raised by my grandmother, Minia Lekarelek, an ancien, she only spoke Inuktitut, and as a little girl myself growing up, I would have to translate for her. She had many visitors from around the world of tourists who tried trekking and who did trek to the North Pole, as Resolute Bay was a pit stop. She even sewed many of their clothing because it is extremely cold up there. Long story short, my grandparents, Anansiakuk, Atatsiakuk, they used faith to survive the hunger, the lies, the heartache, and the very dark winters up there, because in the winter it's 24-hour darkness. So I learned to read in Inuktitut from the Bibles they had, and I learned to interpret for my Anansiak by learning English from school. Now, there are many Inuit who live and come from the circumpolar Arctic. In this case, my guests and I are Inuit from Canada, and we speak Inuktitut, though others, Inukhativut, also speak Inuinnaqtun. And there are many dialects, but in these days we can mostly understand each other. Louise and I have raised our children in Iqaluit, that's the capital city of Nunavut, and the hub for Inuit from across our territory. And I'll be introducing you in these episodes to my Inukhati. These are my fellow Inuit. They are working so hard to keep our language alive, and they're doing all kinds of amazing things, like starting an all-Inuit TV channel, and by describing what it's like to leave a life in an outpost camp to attend school. And then also we're going to talk about what lateral violence is doing and hurting to so many parts of our cultures, including our languages. but I'm going to talk to them about what they are doing to address those issues. My first guest today, though, she owns a book publishing company. She is originally from Kayaptugapik, also known as Clyde River in English, and she grew up with Inuktitut as her first language and learned to read Inuktitut from the Bible as well. Tana, ukhakatigi si yaka kang tuga pimiu ingyak tuga piu yak tuti ukha suri suri ga kita yung mga tusang narit suri. Here is my conversation with Louise Flaherty. She's the co-owner of Inhabit Media, the first Inuit-owned and independent publishing company. But I also love their dialect in Inuktitut. So I just wanted to go back a little bit to your life in Kayaptugapik. Many of our listeners may not know that Inuit have different dialects. We have a universal language, Inuktitut. I've always found that people from Kayaptugapik have such a beautiful dialect where it sounds like singing to me. Have you ever thought about that?
growing up speaking it, I have never noticed it, that I never thought that we were singing, but only until recently when it was pointed out, I started trying to listen. What do they mean when we speak in a singing tone or singing manner? And it's probably because of our hey.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Yeah. So you grew up only speaking Inuktitut?
Yes.
When did you learn to speak English?
I think I only started learning in grade one, because I grew up with my late grandparents, who I called my Anana and Atata. Although I also grew up with my parents as well, but I was raised by a unilingual Inuktitut speaker. So I spoke it until I think we were in grade one when we were starting to learn English. And not long after, when they received, of course, mail, they'd be in English, and they would ask me what this letter was. At a very young age, I started reading documents that were too advanced for my little mind. Yeah,
that's amazing. I share that with you, as I was the interpreter for my late Anansia, my grandmother. So they really depended on us because they didn't speak any English whatsoever. So with that in mind, have you held on to that with a passion to create books in Inuktitut? Mm-hmm. Or where does that passion come from?
I think it comes from, I grew up reading. Of course, when my Anana, my late grandmother, found out that I was able to read in syllabics, she put me in the church choir right away. So where text had meaning. So the hymns, and of course I've read all the Sunena Tusiutit prayer book. Knew it almost by heart. I could probably lead a service as a child. So anyway, my parents were subscribers to Reader's Digest, Mom to True Story. And so we had encyclopedias. We had books, but going to school, there were very limited books in Inuktitut. They started appearing, but they were done by hand with ditto machines that our classroom assistants prepared for us students. And going to school and then going to teacher education and having been a teacher, there were books when I became a teacher, but again, they weren't coming fast enough. And I wanted my grandchildren to be able to see themselves in the books that I couldn't see myself in. When I drew pictures as a kindergartner, they'd be blonde with blue eyes standing next to an apple tree, which I've never seen before.
That is so cute. And I think we all share similar stories in a sense where we were basically born and raised speaking Inuktitut and having learned English. But given that, I think we also noticed the decline in Inuktitut speaking. And how, with what the work you do as a publisher of books, how would you like to change that?
I've been trying to do my part. It comes with challenges because, as you know, as Inuktitut speakers, we have so many dialects. And we have freelance translators that will translate some of our books into Inuktitut if they were written by educational authors. And they are in the language or the dialect of the freelancer. But unless the author submits their work in Inuktitut first, it's in the author's dialect. So I've been trying to make sure that our youth have documented published books that they can refer to, which we could never do when we were looking for terms, words, even just stories. It's very important because not with the residential schools, our parents, my mother definitely grew up with a notion that, because it was drilled to them, that in order to get in life, you have to know and be able to speak in English. With my generation, I think that changed, where we are reclaiming, reviving our language more. But then it comes at a fault where, because they grew up listening to the language and that it wasn't very important, to change that mindset is harder because they almost won, right? Mm-hmm. Up to now, people still hear, oh, you have to learn English in order to get ahead in life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good that we are bilingual, but it made me realize the importance of being able to speak in my language, and my language had importance when I was taking teacher training. We used to have Wednesday seminars, and one of our instructors always, our seminar topics were always thought-provoking. And the question was, is Inuktitut important? That whole seminar, an hour of it, made me realize, wait, my language is just as important because I've been brushing it aside. So since then, I've been almost like on a mission to make sure that our language is visible.
Mm-hmm. And so much kudos to you. Anyone who's working on revitalization of anything, I think, is a hero to me, because it's a lot of work and you're up against all the things that were taught in residential school, as you mentioned. But for our listeners' sake, as you mentioned, you were a former teacher. Even people in Canada, like fellow Canadians, don't know where Nunavut is, or for the fact that there are Inuit right across Canada from Tuktoyaktuk all the way to Labrador. So to try and describe in Nunavut specifically the dialects, what do you mean when you say there's different dialects for our listeners?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are main dialects in four main dialects in Nunavut. Saniklok being the most south is more in part with Nunavik. Qikiqtaaluk is almost divided into South Baffin and North Baffin, and Clyde River being in the center is a mixture of both. And then we have Kivalliq speakers, and they have various dialects because they are from different tribes as well. And then we have Natsilik and Inuinaktut. So, and even saying that each community has their specific little dialects amongst themselves, right? I'm right next where I grew up, right in between Qikiq Taqjaq and Mittimatarik, Pond Inlet. And I grew up listening to both dialects. And mine is a mixture of Panirtuk with my Anana coming from Panirtuk. So you become aware of the differences. And instead of my way of saying is better than your way of saying it, you just have an appreciation. You learn to become multi-dialectal when you have an appreciation for dialects.
Mm-hmm. And so does that pose challenges to the books you're coming up with when you're dealing with the author speaking a different dialect than the translator?
Sometimes we will, but we'll ask authors which translator they want, because we have a list of freelancers from various communities. And we ask them, does it matter which dialect it is in? In most cases, it's not. But when it comes to creating educational resources, I think different communities are wanting to see books in all their dialects. So that would be one book times 25 different variations, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a challenge if you have been given a small portion of money to do all those, which we don't have. Mm-hmm. To me, Inuktitut is one language, because we can understand almost everyone now being exposed to, and I guess living in Iqaluit is a bonus, because it's like you said earlier, it's a hub and people from all over are here in Iqaluit. So we hear lots of dialects among speakers. It was never a challenge. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying, I mean, I worry, because if we have this dialectal fight, nothing will progress, right? Because what you are given, you can understand. It's just a different way of saying a word or a term in this whole book that you will probably have to ask what this means. But then again, I always use the Bible as an example, because our grandparents learned to read from the Bible, which was in one dialect of whoever that translator was. Mm-hmm. And nobody stood up and said, this is wrong, it's not in my dialect. And nobody threw that book in church, right? Mm-hmm. It was used. Mm-hmm. And if there were terms that people did not understand, they made sure to learn what it was. And it becomes a great learning opportunity, because you're adding new words to your mind, to your vocabulary list.
Now, going back to that, to the Bible and the hymn songs that we all learned at our generations, I don't know if everyone knows that Inuit culture was an oral culture, whereas all the stories that we have heard to this day were passed on orally, and many are hundreds of years old. So, with that in mind, what is your mandate as a publisher to keep those stories alive?
We started off with creating books from legends, because we can't document them fast enough. The people that lived out on the land are quickly passing away or passing over, coming from an oral tradition. Like you said, our language is very old when it comes to even the Ayarangnak, the string games that we have, our stories, so that they were told through Ayarangnak as well. And some Ayarangusit figures in our string games go back to the Woolly Mammoth days, where there's a word for Kiligvak, which is that. And it tells you how old our language is, right? So, but we are trying to document everything as fast as we can for our future generation, who will only have these books to refer to if we don't strive to learn our language and teach it down to our grandkids and great-grandkids.
I love that you mentioned naming. I mean, there's so many beautiful things about language and culture, but the specifics of naming in our culture, I find so beautiful. Who were you named after?
I actually have 9 names.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so during our the time I was born, I guess there had been some deaths in friends of our parents and friends of our grandparents, and the names, most of my namesakes are male, and so I grew up as a Ilnik to a lot of our community members. I was a boy through my namesake, so I wasn't taught how to sew, how to clean skins, other than to have to help my grandmother. But I grew up hunting mm-hmm. and butchering. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the names that were bestowed upon me.
And so, speaking of butchering, hunting, sewing, skinning, these are a lot of things, unfortunately, that many of us didn't get to learn for whatever reasons, and residential schools plays mm-hmm. a big part in that. And so how would you like to reflect those teachings in books? Is it possible?
Yes, it's possible. We have started creating, we have an awesome book called Caribou Clothing from Igloolik that we did with a researcher. And we have books now on kamik making, on hunting practices, on survival. If an author comes to us with a story idea, we'll look at it. Almost all of our books are educational books. They teach children, people, about who we are.
So where do you see our language going? Where do you see Inuktitut headed? From all your experiences, how do you see the status of Inuktitut?
I think we have to change the trend. I think we have to do our part instead of pointing fingers at that person's not speaking Inuktitut. We have to start within ourselves. Otherwise, if we keep thinking or expecting someone else to speak, we're going to lose it, because we have to make our language cool. We have to make sure that our youth are hearing it.
So going back to the Bible that was written by someone who wasn't Inuk, so Inuit mm-hmm. learned to read in syllabics, and it's similar to the Cree writing system. With that in mind, what difference would a unified writing system do for us, in your opinion?
We have dual writing system. We have the syllabics and Roman orthography, Kaliuyapate and Kaniuyapate in syllabics. When you look at social media, a lot of the youth are reverting to Roman orthography. And we do have some books that are now in Roman orthography to reach those audience. And I believe for people that are trying to reclaim the language, that already know how to read in English, that it's easier as long as they know what I-U-A is. That's the only difference, because we use I-U-A as our vowels, right?
Can you do me a favor and go back to your teaching days or grade one days and share the Inuktitut alphabet? Can I say alphabet? E. Syllabics for us?
I did teach kindergartens, and what I used was the ibitiki, and then
what would you like our listeners, wherever in the world they may be, to know about Inuktitut and why we love it and why it's important to understand that we still have people that do not speak English and speak only Inuktitut.
I've attended World Indigenous Conferences on Education every 3 years, I believe. We all have the same Indigenous story. There are some speakers. Again, I have come across people that are that have not moved forward because of their dialect fights, which is not going to stop me, because if we keep fighting about dialects, we won't progress. We're just going to lose our language. I mean, we have done a lot of work to preserve our language and our culture. I would encourage fellow Indigenous friends and Indigenous people around the world just to move ahead and take initiative instead of just waiting around for other people to do it. Because when it comes from you, yourself, it's authentic. It's authentic Inuit.
I appreciated so much of this conversation, and we will continue the conversation as Inuit, as we support each other in the work that we do. Thank you so much, Louise Flaherty, and I wish you all the best in continuing this important work.
Thank you so much, and I don't think I have time to age and grow very old because we have, or retire, because there's so much to do, right?
That was my conversation with Louise Flaherty. She's the co-owner of Inhabit Media. It's a book publishing company. And I respect how she says that we're all going to lose out if we just keep on fighting over what dialects we should be using to tell our Inuit stories. Our languages keep us connected, you know, the same way music forges a connection. I would like to dedicate this song to my grandparents. Nakukmitaka sapili loksimangituning inuanansia kukatapong anuto loksimatilugin. To my grandparents, thank you for not giving up. Here's Tujad. Yes, that would be me and my cousin. We were a duo a long time ago. And Tujad was also the name of our community. Here's a song called Kayusita.
Thank you. lost, nobody ever wins. I can't wait until my ship comes in. I think I hear voices in the wind telling me my ship will soon come in.
That is a song called Kayusita by my former group, Tujat.